Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Zoltan Grossman. You can find more about him at his name, which is Zoltan, Zoltan, Grossman, Grossman. Zoltan is a political cultural geographer. He teaches at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. He got his PhD from the University of Wisconsin, and he is the son of Hungarian immigrants to the United States, and the author of a terrific article that we will be discussing that you can find at Counterpunch called "The Enemy of Your Enemy is Not Always Your Friend." Zoltan Grossman, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Great to be here. Thanks.
It's great to have you on. This article about the Ukraine has gotten a great deal of attention, and deservedly so. What is the presence now of far-right parties and individuals in the new Ukrainian government?
Well, it was pretty clear, especially towards the end of the, whatever you want to call it, uprising, revolution, coup in Kiev, that two groups in particular, Svoboda, which means freedom, which is a far-right Ukrainian nationalist, I would call them fascist organization, and Pravi Sektor, which is an even farther right, if that's possible,
the really right pro-Nazi. Sector.
Yeah, right sector. And they really trace their origins or their ideology more to National Socialism. They really are Nazis, and in particular have adopted a lot of the symbology of the global white supremacist movement, including the white power movement in the United States, using Confederate flags and symbols from groups associated with the Klan and the Nazis here. And so it was clear towards the end that although the Maidan protests in Independence Square in Kiev against the government of Viktor Yanukovych were very broad-based, included a lot of different parts of Ukrainian society, from the left to the right, ecologists, gay rights activists. People are just upset with corruption and police brutality. Very clearly, these groups moved in. As it became more violent, they made it more violent and really polarized the situation between the Ukrainian government forces, the supposedly pro-Russian forces, and the Ukrainian nationalist forces. In the same way, I think we see in Syria, where the uprising against al-Assad was from a wide base of Syrian society, concerned about the actions of the government in Syria, and has really become polarized between the government forces and Islamist rebels, who have kind of, because of their militancy and action, have supplanted the more supposedly moderate rebel element. We also saw the same thing in Libya, Gaddafi warning against the Islamists, who eventually blow back against the Americans in Benghazi because they didn't really pay attention to that element of the very movement that they were supporting. So it was pretty clear that about 30% of the protesters, this is a group called Anti-Fascist Action Ukraine that's been monitoring the far right in Ukraine, opposed to Yanukovych, but also opposed to some of the people who've been fighting against Yanukovych. And I'm sure that number increased as the fighting increased a couple of weeks ago. And that's one thing, to have far-right elements in a protest movement. The more moderate folks can't really do much about it. Even in the Occupy movement, it was a very broad base. There were some right-wingers who became part of it. It's another thing entirely for this victorious revolution, putsch, whatever you want to call it, to have the far-right parties in new interim government, and that's exactly what's happened. This new interim prime minister, who's backed by the United States, has named particular members of Svoboda to, you know, particular posts, especially vice premier for economic affairs. They've taken control of the ministries of education, agriculture, the environment, and one of the co-founders of Svoboda, which means freedom, was named secretary of Security and National Defense Committee, which is a really important post, with control over police and military forces. The deputy is from the farthest of the far right, Dmytro Yarosh, who is head of right sector. Really looks back with fondness on the Ukrainian insurgent army, has really glorified, both groups have glorified this group, that welcomed the Nazi invasion of Ukraine in 1941. And eventually the Germans turned against this group because they wanted a Ukrainian state, and the Germans didn't want that because they wanted Ukrainian land and saw Slavs as subhuman. So these far-right groups depict the Ukrainian insurgent army as somehow a resistance movement, but you're really not a resistance movement if you wanted to be a Nazi and the other Nazis wouldn't let you play. But leading up to the Maidan uprising, there's been a rehabilitation of the leader of the Ukrainian insurgent army from back then, Bandera, and marches on his birthday last January, very aggressive push against any kind of bilingualism in Ukraine, whereby Russians and other minorities would be able to have some kind of linguistic right within what these groups want to put forth as a pure Ukrainian state. And, of course, this has caused a backlash, an inevitable backlash, among Russians, also among other minorities, and has contributed, perhaps hasn't caused, but has certainly contributed to the polarization between Russia and Ukraine, which is entirely predictable, especially in the Crimea region.
Now, we're speaking with Zoltan Grossman, whose article in Counterpunch is called "The Enemy of Your Enemy is Not Always Your Friend." And you mention in that article the hypocrisy in the U.S. media's lack of attention or concern. And I would include U.S. officials. We have Hillary Clinton comparing Putin to Hitler, but no mention that I'm aware of people who can, and as you say, legitimately be called Nazis in the new Ukrainian government.
Well, I think the U.S. often... And the EU often speak out when there are far-right, especially anti-immigrant parties doing very well in Western Europe, in France, in the Netherlands, in Austria. Back in 2000, a far-right party actually entered the cabinet of the Austrian government, and there were sanctions put on by the EU. But a few years ago, a far-right party entered the government of Latvia, and it was barely noticed. And now there seems to be this message out there that, well, there might be very tiny elements of the fascists in this revolution, but the Russians are just exaggerating. In fact, the Russians are exaggerating to some extent by saying all the protesters are fascists, but it's equally wrong to say that the presence of fascists and Nazis in the Ukrainian government is can merely be dismissed as Russian exaggeration or hyperbole. I think the take-home message is that perhaps it's embarrassing for a far-right party to enter a government, enter an executive branch of government in a Western country, but because this revolution is directed against Russia, all evil comes from the East, and all evil is embodied in Russia, and the presence of the Ukrainian far-right in government is more or less an inconvenient reminder that evil can also come out of a pro-Western side. The other ironic thing about both Svoboda and Pravi Sektor is without fail, this uprising in Kiev in Ukraine was depicted as pro-European Union and wanting integration with the European Union. But both of these organizations, like other fascist organizations in Western Europe, are quite hostile to the European Union and see it as somehow this internationalist, globalized economic force that's bad for Ukrainians. And you hear this from groups in Hungary and Greece and all throughout Western Europe, an anti-EU sentiment. And in fact, Svoboda has observer status, because it's not an EU country, within the European Parliament with the Alliance of European National Movements, which are the far-right parties that are in the European Parliament in order to dismantle the EU. And Pravi Sektor, the right sector, has a slogan against the regime and integration, against the pro-Russian government of Yanukovych and against the EU. So this is never pointed out, this contradiction. And so I think the media has been really irresponsible with this kind of good guy, bad guy, white hat, black hat kind of depiction of the Ukrainian revolution as somehow akin to the earlier people power revolution that we've seen around the world, and not seeing that this also has elements of the breakup of Yugoslavia, in which I think the focus was solely on ethnic cleansing by the Serbs and not by the U.S. allied Croatians or Kosovar Albanians who are also engaged in ethnic cleansing of minorities. In Afghanistan, all of the criticism is on the Taliban for instance, restricting women's rights, when in fact a pro-U.S. government 4 years before the Taliban came to power was the first one, the one that threw out the Soviets, was the first to restrict women's rights and religious minority rights. And I mentioned in Libya and Syria that revolutions against secular Russian-backed dictators have strengthened Islamist militias. So it's a real double standard to simply point out the atrocities by the other side and not to recognize that the pro-Western side in all of these revolutions have committed atrocities and aren't necessarily even as pro-Western as they are originally depicted in the media.
In fact, it could be counterproductive to the agenda of putting so-called missile defense missiles in the Ukraine, putting Ukraine into NATO, if that's the U.S. agenda. I mean, when you say that up to 30% of the protesters, and maybe more as it got more violent, were from the far right, there was that other 70%, and there has been great U.S. efforts to invest in this movement, and we had an assistant secretary of state out there handing out cookies to the protester. I mean, to what extent was U.S. manipulation a factor and effective here, and to what extent was it misguided and counterproductive in terms of the outcome?
Well, I think that there's always U.S. influence in these so-called color revolutions. There definitely was in Ukraine in 2004, Georgia, Serbia, other places. I wouldn't say that they're creations. I think social movements are much more complex than that. There's definitely an attempt to take advantage of a situation where people are opposing an unpopular government. But I think in particular that the bugged phone call of the State Department official Nuland and her statements against the EU, against one of the opposition figures, Klitschko, which actually elevated a bit in my eyes, and her basically identifying who the U.S. wanted as prime minister, which is exactly what happened, and the willingness to keep Svoboda, the fascist organization, in the coalition as long as they weren't embarrassingly out front and center. And when John McCain went to Ukraine last December to support the opposition, he met with Oleg Tanyubok, the head of the Svoboda Party, and was criticized for that. So, you know, it's an embarrassing, it's an embarrassment for the United States if the media would cover it. The BBC has started to cover it. I haven't seen a single expose in the New York Times, which was very eager to expose what was happening in Austria with the far-right government there 14 years ago. But I haven't seen a single expose of the far-right influence in the government, again. Not just in the parliament. There are a lot of European countries that have the far-right in their parliament. Russia's one of them, and Russia certainly has a Russian nationalist movement that itself is anti-Semitic. But the difference is the line that's been crossed here is to bring them into powerful positions within the executive branch of government where they have real power to determine what's happening. The U.S. hasn't done a thing about it.
It's quite a bind for people in the Ukraine and in the Crimea. I wonder if you were an Ukrainian and you were in Kiev and this was happening and you knew the U.S. manipulation and the U.S. funding behind some of these movements and you knew Russia's interests and you knew what was happening, would you have joined in the protests?
You know, that's a good question. And if I was Ukrainian and I had exactly, I mean, it's a parallel universe, but if I had exactly the same feelings, I probably would have joined against government, against the police force. And I think Europeans and people in all the rest of the world understand that there's often more than two sides to a conflict. There isn't just this white hat, black hat thing, where you can, for instance, oppose the government of Syria and also oppose U.S. airstrikes against that government because it would make matters worse. and you can oppose a particular president of your country, but also see that the enemy of your enemy is not necessarily your friend, which is the title of my article. And I think that there are nuances, and I hope that what happens out of this situation in both Ukraine and Crimea is that the Ukrainian nationalists don't take total power, and that perhaps in the election other voices are chosen. Similarly with some of the anti-Semitic Russian nationalist groups, which are doing very well right now because of the situation in Crimea, that they are disowned by Russians. But I think it's really incumbent on Ukrainians. And I want to point out one other thing is that just because Yanukovych was definitely cooperating in some ways with Russia, although he was an embarrassment to Russia in much the same way the far right in Ukraine can be an embarrassment to the United States, he's hardly an anti-imperialist, and not even so much as Assad or Gaddafi, because he sent troops to Iraq and Afghanistan. He's perfectly willing to cooperate with the U.S. administration on natural resources, on global extension of U.S. military power. That was no problem to him. So just because somebody is targeted by the United States doesn't mean that somehow they're of the people. I think what you see is definitely a push, an eastward expansion of NATO, an attempt by the U.S. To assert its control in former Soviet space over the objections of Russia. And Yanukovych was in the way of that, definitely. What's interesting is that this new situation may make things even more unstable to make even the goals of the United States harder to achieve. We'll see exactly what happens out of the current situation. But there's definitely a polarization between the West and Russia over Crimea. I'm not sure how long that's going to last, and I don't think the West can do a whole heck of a lot about what the Russians have done in Crimea. That's a recent addition to Ukraine from 1954. The Russians, as well as the Ukrainians, by the way, in Crimea, are quite recent settlers. Since the 1940s, when Stalin forcibly relocated the Crimean Tatars from the region. So it is a little bit different than the rest of Ukraine. And I think the U.S. can do as much about Crimea as the USSR could have done anything about the invasion of Panama, another country with strategic bases and a traditional sphere of influence of the United States. And I think Putin knew that the West couldn't do very much if he pushed it.
Do you think the people, the majority of the people in Crimea, want to be independent or want to join Russia? And how do you think the vote will go? And what do you think is likely to be the outcome of increased military presence from both sides in the region, of the United States military and the Russian?
Well, if the conflict spreads into the rest of southern and eastern Ukraine, where Russians have a much deeper roots, much more of a historic presence, then you could easily see Russian military intervention and NATO coming in on the West. And there is still that possibility. But as for the referendum, I don't know how it's going to go. The Ukrainians say that because it's under Russian occupation, the vote will be rigged one way for Russia. The Crimean Tatar leadership has called for a boycott, so I think Tatars aren't going to be participating. I don't know if Ukrainians are going to be participating. I don't know if most Russians would favor a stronger autonomy and to bring back the autonomous status of Crimea that existed right after Ukraine became independent. And there was a situation like in Quebec or Scotland today where you had a secessionist government that didn't necessarily have the popular support to secede, but did represent a definite sentiment and could operate as an autonomous republic. So there may be people who feel that way, but it's hard to predict the outcome of a referendum Putin himself has said that he doesn't want Crimea to become part of Russia, but to be a real autonomous region. So I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen there. But this is a classic case of, you know, like in Yugoslavia, ethnic groups remaining outside the borders of these new republics. And can they secede from the seceders? Do they have the same right of secession from Ukraine that Ukraine had from the Soviet Union? And so this question hasn't been resolved and won't be anytime soon.
And what was the motivation in repealing the bilingualism law in the Ukraine? And was it these far-right groups that were behind that?
Yes, they were very much behind. As a matter of fact, 2 years ago, if you look up 2012, there were pretty violent protests by Svoboda against the original passing of this law in the Ukrainian parliament in the Rada in Kiev. And it really became a rallying cry, and they claim that that's when the ball began rolling for this revolution against Yanukovych, that was the central issue, not democracy, not the EU, but the sense that Ukraine is for the Ukrainians, and any rights for Russians, or for that matter, other minorities. There are Rusins, there are Hungarians, there are Romanians within Ukraine, that takes away from their vision of a purely Ukrainian state. That's especially strong in the areas in the far west of Ukraine that used to be part of either the Austro-Hungarian Empire or interwar Poland, or both, in which there's very strong nationalist sentiment, and which actually a lot of the Ukrainians there are there in cities like Lviv, because the original inhabitants, who are mainly Poles and Jews, were forcibly removed by the Ukrainian insurgent army during World War II, which participated in a lot of massacres of Jews. Between 50 and 100,000 Poles, Catholic Poles, were killed by this Ukrainian insurgent army, which is now being rehabilitated and celebrated in Ukraine. And so the nationalist sentiment is extremely high in the far western part of Ukraine, so much so that statues not only of Lenin, which has happened a lot around East and Central Europe, but of Soviet soldiers who liberated the Republic during World War II are being torn down. People who want to lay flowers on the graves of some of their relatives who died in the war are being hounded and literally assaulted in that part of the country. And so there's a very strong feeling that the wrong side won World War II, and that somehow out of this situation, not necessarily out of the successful revolution against Yanukovych, but that for them created the conditions whereby they can reverse the disaster of 1945. So it's not just about opposing Russia. It's not just about opposing a particular leader or supporting democracy or the EU. There are other agendas in play here. And I'm really curious to see what the West, the EU, and the U.S. are going to do about it.
You know, you mentioned that the protests grew more violent and that these right-wing groups added to that violence. I'm wondering what you know about how that happened and what you think of the other leaked phone call, the one suggesting the belief that it was, in fact, some of these new members of this new government that were behind the snipers as opposed to the old government. Who was firing the guns here?
I think that there are different stages of the revolution over the space of days and even hours, and I think definitely you can see the Berkut riot police being very brutal against some of the protesters. Could be that some of them were told these are all fascist Nazis, and that may be the case. I think there was definitely shooting from the government side. I don't know the facts. I know that there was a leaked phone call between an EU official and Foreign Minister of Estonia, who was basically saying that it seemed as if they were saying Pravi Sektor may have been involved in some of the sniper fire as a way to discredit the regime by killing some of the protesters actually opposing Yanukovych. I don't know beyond that phone call any of the facts about that. I did notice that the Foreign Minister of Poland Sikorsky was on BBC a couple of nights ago and said some very weird things about Jarosz, the head of Pravý sektor, that implied some of the same ideas, and I kind of wanted to play that tape back. I don't know the facts about it. I'm sometimes suspicious about conspiracy theories because I think reality is weird enough, but I wouldn't put it past Pravý sektor or Svoboda fighters that they may have deliberately contributed to the atrocities against the protesters. And right now, I'm actually a little concerned that as we're moving towards the referendum in Crimea, they must be chomping at the bit to want to provoke some kind of a ground war between Ukrainian and Russian forces, even if Russian forces would have the advantage of it, because it would create the conditions for them to somehow prevail in this revolution by further polarizing Russians and Ukrainians. So I think that whatever happened in the past on Maidan Square, I think the potential is there for these groups to further stoke violence.
With two nuclear nations looming from either side in Russia and the United States, we don't have, I'm afraid, very many minutes left here. What can people of goodwill do from inside or outside the Ukraine in such a complex situation? Are there nonviolent, pluralist, democratic groups to support? Are there initiatives to back? What can people do that would be helpful?
Well, I think first off, to educate ourselves about the complexities of the situation, and not just to be influenced by the latest Facebook meme or YouTube video that depicts the atrocities of only one side and not the violence coming from the pro-Western side, and to spread the word about that and to put that out there on social media so Ukrainian voters themselves can see that some of the people who prevailed in this situation are going to besmirch, are going to discredit the image of Ukraine in the rest of society, especially Ukrainian-Americans, Ukrainian-Canadians, to speak out about this situation and to demand that the far right not be part of a Ukrainian government. That's a very clear line to cross. They can certainly, you can't stop them from being the parliament in the democratic society. But you can stop them from being part of government. And I think especially to pressure the State Department to speak out about this, and or at least to not ignore it as is currently happening, or minimize it or dismiss it as merely Russian propaganda. It's not just Russian propaganda. And it actually feeds some of the far-right forces in Russia to have a situation like this in Ukraine. So I think that's really all we can do, from a distance, but I think that that's a start.
Good words of wisdom from Zoltan Grossman. He is a political cultural geographer. He teaches at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and you should read his article, "The Enemy of Your Enemy is Not Always Your Friend." Zoltan Grossman, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.